Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi everyone, it's obvious. I'm John Verhoeven, and I was a cop back in the 80s in Sydney.
And I'm Paul Verhoeven, John's son. I'm an author, and I wrote two books about Dad's time as a cop.
The first five seasons of Loose Unit spanned my time in general duties, forensics, my time as a firefighter, and even my stint running a funeral home.
This season, we're visiting the locations of Australia's most notorious, baffling, horrific crimes, and looking at what happened there.
From Snowtown to the family. From the Morehouse murders to haunted highways. This season of Loose Units is your go-to guide to the worst crimes in Australian true crime history.
Welcome to Loose Units, The Shadow Files.
Hello and welcome to Loose Units, The Shadow Files, and welcome to part two of our look at the terrifying case of the BTK killer. Now, just a little housekeeping up front. Dad, I understand you turned something pretty shitty into something significantly better within the last 15 minutes. Is that correct?
Well, Christine and I, just before she went to work, we were finishing our Wim Hof breathing.
Oh, boy.
And we were in the fourth set. Uh-huh. Sounds like a tennis game.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, there was this sort of huge noise. And then it was like being in a rainforest. Sort of like, it was like being in a cloud. And there was all this sort of moisture coming through our front door or the balcony door. And these guys, they're steam cleaning, they're spraying.
Oh, like a pressure hose.
Super high pressure hose. There are at least six guys. And they've mounted this huge compressor underneath our lounge room window.
Uh-huh.
So it was all rather traumatic. I had to dash out. And basically, all our drying was on the balcony getting saturated.
Oh, shit.
It was a bun fight. And Christine was absolutely pissed off, putting it mildly. And she actually, we didn't finish our breathing. She had to run downstairs, spoke to the people and didn't really, you know, achieve a lot. And I thought, look, you know, we've got the podcast. We're doing part two of this, quite frankly, horrific story.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down and I spoke to the sort of the head guy, this English guy, and I thought, look, what on earth can we do? And then I just said it just came to me. It was an epiphany. I said, are you into true crime? And he said, I love true crime. I said, well, how about this?
Check out
Loose Units.
Oh.
Get ready for this. He checks out Loose Units. He orders the entire crew to shut down for us to record. And I think that's so nice of him.
That's very sweet. I sincerely hope you plugging the show hasn't completely fucked their day of work. But just a very big thank you to the crew of people.
So kind, so lovely.
Just doing their jobs and pausing specifically for this episode. So yeah. A massive shout out.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, housekeeping out of the way, thank yous dispensed with. We can continue. So last week we dealt with the beginnings of the BTK killer's killings, basically. We dealt with the death of the Otero family, the murder of this entire family in their house. If you haven't listened, go back and listen to part one of our look at the BTK killer. We've jumped forward, not very far, mind you, to April the 4th, 1974. To the second, it's weird, Dad, because technically this would be the fifth murder, but it feels like the second because it's the second incident. Because the first murder was on January 15, 1974. February, March, April. Okay, so 3 months later, that seems like a pretty quick turnaround.
Well, when you listen to the judge, ultimately, in the court case,
yeah,
the judge refers to this particular case. I agree with what you said, Paul. It seems like the second murder. It's the second crime. Yeah. But the judge, described it as the fifth indictment. So one indictment, one life, it has to be broken down into individual components.
Makes sense.
But we're talking about the second crime or the fifth victim here.
Yep.
And her name was, and you will note the tense that I use, Catherine Bright. And I'm sitting here in the silence looking at a photograph of her.
Yeah.
And she's 21. I just turned 14 in 1974. Mm. And it's sad to think that I was a young guy on the northern beaches. I was in a band. I was going to a great high school.
Sorry, you buried the lead there. You're in a what?
I was in a band.
Were you?
Didn't you know that? Paul, are you joking? Paul, I was in a band. I don't understand why you find it so funny. I'm just painting a picture of what a joyous...
It's the most John Verhoeven thing ever to do a fucking podcast for 6 years and then in the middle of the grimmest shit ever go, it was 1974, I was young, I was in a band.
Paul, Paul, it's important. I'm painting a picture of two extremes.
What kind of band were you in?
A brass band.
Oh.
Well, Dad, there was woodwind as well.
Dad, when someone says I was in a band, we think garage band, we think rock band, we don't think you're in a... Hang on. Was this a school band?
School band, yeah.
You were not in a band in a band. This is not the summer of 69, Dad. You were in the school band. But you can't paint a picture of yourself as a freewheeling 14-year-old. I was in a band. You know what image that conjures up.
I'm trying to sort of conjure up the image of, a carefree, happy lad juxtaposed by what we're about to talk about, which frankly is fucked.
Yeah, okay, Dad. But, I mean, look... Come on, listeners, back me up. Like, when someone says, I was young, I was in a band, that is not the typical usage, but you are anything but typical, so please.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just sort of letting the listeners know.
I know.
That I was, Dad, I had a lot to look forward to. I guess that's a very critical point with this story, And I'm sad in a way that as a 14-year-old, even though this story was so terrible... We didn't know that these terrible things were happening because it takes so long to catch this fuckwit.
And you didn't hear about this stuff when you were younger because...
No, I didn't. Well, no one had heard about it in these years because he hadn't been caught.
Yeah.
Which is really important.
Okay.
And yes, I do see. And I guess it's probably one of the only podcasts, true crime podcasts on this planet, that manages to infuse... a little bit of brevity and jocularity into what is actually a terrible topic. And I think it's nice to think that you and I deal with terrible topics, but with our live shows, what's the venue? What type of venue do we use?
It's always a comedy venue.
Always.
And that's not because we're making fun of the stories. It's because we're just pals goofing around. Okay, Dad, listen, we've established that you were in a band. We've had a laugh. So you were 14 at the time.
Yeah.
But across the globe, what was happening?
Okay, well, in Wichita, there was this... There'd already been the terrible case of the Otero murders, the family.
Yeah. Over in January.
Correct. And then on the 4th of April, 1974... the BTK killer,
Dennis Rader,
was on the prowl. Now, he used to describe the process as he categorized everything as a project. And we know, based on our previous podcast, that he also had what was called his special kit. And in the kit, he had all of those implements that he would use in the commission of his crimes.
Yeah.
But on this particular day, he had already driven past this lovely Catherine's house. He'd seen her a few times. He described himself as being in the stalking phase. He was very clinical in his in the way he described the phases that he went through. So there's all the different sort of... So it's sort of a process of building up to ultimately the day. And on this particular day, it's around about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. He parks his car in the campus of the university.
Okay.
He then walks one block to a house that he already knows that this particular girl lives there. He then goes around to the back of the house, breaks in through a rear door. There's no one at home. He's cased the joint. He then waits in a bedroom. Now, there are a few bedrooms in this house, which is important. And he waits, and then all of a sudden, around about two, he hears the front door open and he jumps out to surprise her. He's armed with a 22 caliber pistol. And to his surprise, shock, and horror, with Catherine is her brother.
Oh, no.
So his name's Kevin. He's 19. So he's 2 years younger than Catherine. And together they stand there. And he goes through the same modus operandi which he'd used with the Otero family, which is to say that he's an escapee. But he does it in such a way as to give them some sense of calmness. And he explains to them that he wants food, he wants some money, primarily he wants their motor vehicle. It's a complete sham, this story. But the first thing he has to do is he gets young Kevin to tie his sister up. And how he does that, he binds her wrists and her ankles. Once he's done that, he then takes at gunpoint Kevin into the second bedroom. That's why I mentioned there were a number of bedrooms in this house.
Mm-hmm.
And he then begins to tie Kevin. Now, what he does, and this is a little bit unusual, I thought it was a bit, because remember that this is the second sort of offense. If you include the murder of the four as being the first offence, this is the second offence.
Mm-hmm.
There's a time gap of around about 3 to 4 months. And he ties his ankles to the bed, but he doesn't tie his hands up, which is quite bizarre.
Mm.
But in court later on, very interestingly, he explained to the judge that on that particular day, whilst he was armed, he did not bring his standard kit with all his special ties. That's very important, which we'll come to shortly. He then goes back into the bedroom of Catherine, where she is tied by the wrists and ankles. He gets on top of her and he starts to strangle her. Whilst in the process of strangling her, he hears a commotion in the other room. He then leaves Catherine, goes back into the bedroom
mm-hmm.
where Kevin is. Kevin has managed to free his legs and he's just about to stand up. And when he stands up, the offender, he grabs him, throws him to the ground, and a fight ensues. And Dennis Rader manages to pull out his 22 caliber pistol and shoots Kevin in the head. And then Kevin falls to the ground and blood is flowing from the wound. The offender, Dennis, stands up and thinks that he's passed away. He then goes back into Catherine's room.
Yeah.
Catherine has recovered from the initial first session of choking. Mm-hmm. She begins to struggle violently in fear of her own life, and Dennis is strangling her, and she puts up such an incredible fight that he then pulls out a knife. He begins to stab her around the abdomen and the back, and he eventually kills her. He then hears a commotion from the bedroom where he'd left the brother, thinking that he'd killed him. He runs back into that room. So he's traveling in between two rooms. Picture this. It's so surreal. It's in the afternoon. And the brother has regained consciousness, and another fight ensues. But this is quite extraordinary. Dennis then, he had two firearms. He also had a Magnum. He had that, he carried that in a shoulder holster. He then pulls out the Magnum.
No, one was a 22.
One's a 22 and one's a Magnum.
Yep.
He's got two firearms. But what happens is they start fighting again. And in the fight, the young boy, mm-hmm. Kevin, starts to get the better. And at one stage, he actually grabs the firearm, and Dennis actually said in court that he managed to get his thumb, as the gun was about to be fired at him, under the hammer, he sticks his finger in the hammer to prevent himself being shot. He then manages to free the other pistol, and he shoots the young boy a second time in the head.
Okay.
And he then knows for a fact he's now deceased. He then runs back into the bedroom with the girl.
Yep.
He then masturbates over her because they found a lot of semen next to her body. Then he hears this. You can't write this in a movie script. He then hears a noise coming from the brother's room, but he stays with the girl, and then he hears a door open. The first thing he thinks is that it's the police. And then he sort of runs to the door, and he sees the brother that he'd shot twice in the head running down the street. He then runs back into the girl's room. He tidies up, which is slightly bizarre. One can only imagine the stress and trauma and the adrenaline pumping through the veins of our killer.
Yeah.
He'd also stolen two sets of car keys, and he runs out into the front lawn where he tries to figure out what's happening with the keys, and then he realized that the brother had in fact taken one of the cars. So Dennis, now this is one of the things that I, in my research, I found a little bit troubling, is that he'd stabbed Catherine a few times. I'm thinking, you know, wasn't there any blood on his clothing? He then leaves the house. The brother's gone. He then walks back to the university and retrieves his own car. Meanwhile, the brother, who'd been shot twice in the head,
mm-hmm.
he gets in touch with the police. The police come around and...
How is he still alive?
I don't know, Paul, but when the police arrive, Catherine's still alive as well. And they worked on her. They, paramedics worked on her. They gave her blood transfusions. They really worked hard, and she passed away.
God damn it.
Mm.
I know now, this is. I know this seems really silly, but it's just. It's. I feel like we got so close to stopping this, you know?
I know, it's terrible.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
And that the brother is alive today.
Still alive. Okay.
Yep. And it's a tragedy.
Dad, speaking of Kevin Bright somehow surviving this horrifying ordeal, one of the things he did was to help the police with a sketch.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the sketch right now. I don't know how much police sketches help. This isn't particularly detailed. It shows Dennis Rader wearing a beanie at the time, but apart from that, it's pretty nondescript. I mean, does this help?
No.
Okay.
It just tells us that it was a male.
But it did also put that out there in the public, and then apparently two men in prison confessed to the first four murders, or the first incident, the killing of the Otero family, which apparently really pissed off Dennis Rader, who was hungry for credit at this point. In fact, you talked last episode about the fact that he wanted more people to pay attention. He wanted more infamy. So he then sent a letter to a newspaper in Wichita, prompting them to look inside a book at the Wichita Library, which gave a really detailed account of the murder of the family.
Yep.
Stuff that only the person who did the killings would be aware of, right? It wasn't a confession, but it was very, very detailed. And it did, quite tellingly at the end, he did promise that he was going to kill more people. And he said that he'd chosen who his next victim was going to be. And that's where he used the moniker BTK. So he actually said, "I'm the BTK killer." And then he finished off the letter with a terrifying little flourish, which was happy hunting. But when was his next murder? It wasn't for a while, was it?
No, 3 years. But we have discussed how he managed to have these moments, in this case, 3 years, whereby he could basically just become dormant. He's being dormant insofar as he's not out there murdering and committing all sorts of hideous, bizarre, sort of sexualized fantasies.
Yeah.
He can get by during that period simply with trophies.
Right.
We know, and we will continue to gain more information as the podcast continues, that he took the trophies, he took photographs, he took terrible, terrible photographs. And listeners, this case that we will definitely not finish this episode.
Oh, God, no.
It just gets worse and worse and worse. It gets more diabolical, more maniacal.
Can I point out one of the things that really upsets me at this point? So he's in this 3-year holding pattern, right?
Yep.
He's just coasting off the fumes of the trophies and the memories of what he's done. He sends a taunting letter to the police. He sends a taunting letter to the police. But during this time, listeners, and astute listeners will know this because of listening to the last episode, he's got a wife and kids.
Correct.
So he's just going about his life. And apparently his wife, Paula, told him at one point that she was worried because of the serial killer that was in the area. I don't know how that could be completely apocryphal. I don't know how true that is, but it's a very good story flourish. The fact that the wife turns to the serial killer and says, I'm worried about living in this area. It doesn't seem safe. I think there's a serial killer here. And the serial killer in the house says, nah, it's fine. Mm. I don't know how true that is, but it's certainly an interesting aspect of the story.
This particular case had the entire town or city of Wichita almost paralyzed. As I said before, that particularly women would come home, the first thing they did before they went into the house was check to see if the phone lines had been cut. This was in his modus operandi. And apparently that every single party that anyone went to in Wichita, this was the mainstay of the focus of conversation. And these things play on your mind, because in a small community, when you don't know who the offender is, but you know... I mean, in one of the future cases that we're going to come to at some stage, it must be pointed out that Dennis Rader actually lived in the same street. And that in itself is creepy. And when people in a neighbourhood don't know who the offender is, and this particular person is, by all accounts, a very nondescript person who held various offices within the church and the community and organisations, for example, the Boy Scouts, and he just would blend in. But that's part of his disguise, and he's clearly very, very smart.
Yeah.
From an IQ perspective...
Well, cunning. There's a certain degree of cunning there. I mean, you know...
True, it's, true.
Yeah.
He's got all the time in the world.
Mm.
And...
3 years is a long time.
It's a long time.
Yeah.
That's 3 years.
That's where you forget the serial killer is still... That's where you're like, well, they stopped. I mean...
That's right.
Sorry, that's what I would say.
Correct, you know, yeah, correct. Yeah. But in 1977, he decides...
In March, by the way, it's always around the same time of year. Is that a seasonal thing? Because we've gone January,
it's April, after winter.
March, yeah, okay. This one really upsets me.
Mm.
I don't know.
Okay, this is quite bizarre in that Dennis is driving through the town.
Yeah.
And he sees a young boy. He pulls up and Dennis shows the young boy a photograph, doesn't he? And it's a photograph of Dennis's wife and son. Of his own son.
What? Why?
To gain trust.
Okay, so I read that the reason this five-year-old was out by himself in a position where Dennis could get to him, he was heading to the store to get food for his mum, Shirley... Shirley Vian Reif... Is that them?
Yeah.
I'd like to rescind my thank you and add a stop it, please.
Oh.
No, I'm kidding. Okay, so the reason he was at the shop is because he was there getting... This sounds like a made-up story. He was there getting food for his sick mum, Shirley Vian Reif Relford. Shirley Vian Relford.
Mm.
Okay.
It's awfully loud, that noise, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very loud. He may as well have been going to get magic beans. I mean, at this point, you know, it's got a slightly strange fairy tale esque. When you watch a horror film, Dad, and you see the kid kind of wandering into town by themselves, you're screaming, going, "What are you doing? Why are you? What are you?"
But that shows a degree of
safety.
Safety. It paints an image. I mean, I used to, as a 5 year old, living in Armidale, Your parents would say, look, son up, out you go, and we'll see you. We'll call you when it's dark. That's how it was.
But he talks about hunting. He says happy hunting in his letters. He talks about stalking his prey.
Hmm.
But he's going after, you know, docile herbivores. He's going for the weak. He's going for the vulnerable. It's not like he goes, all right, I'm going to stalk some alpha predators, and he goes after, you know, armed police officers or cattle rustlers or whatever. He's a fucking coward. As with all of these killers, he's a fucking coward.
I know, Paul, but the thing is, with the young boy, he knew the boy. Yep. He knew the boy was the son of his next victim.
I see. Okay, so the boy is a backdoor in.
And it's clever because he then goes to the house and the boy recognizes him. The boy opens the door and he, our protagonist, pretends to be a detective. That gives him entree into the family home.
Now, does that have anything... Is there any link there to his time... I guess studying law enforcement, technically.
Yeah,
I
mean,
and he's also spent a bit of time doing the census and stuff, so he knows how to how to inure himself.
He's got children himself.
Yep.
I just can't believe that. I mean, I guess 3 years is a long time. It is a long time. 3 years today is an incredibly long time. In terms of, for example, the news circle, it's another time. So he gains access to the house. And the mother, she has got 4 children.
Right.
And the mother can't be seen at this stage, but she then comes out of another room. She's confronted with Dennis Rader. He's standing there.
Yeah, in the house.
In her home. And what he does, he turns the TV on. Okay. Then he gets the children and he locks the kids in the bathroom. Imagine the terrible, terrible trauma. I don't know whether the mother at this stage, Shirley Vian is her name.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether she would have thought, but this guy he's got his gun out. The kids must have been, they have to have been screaming. And what he does, he then brings the mother into the kitchen. He sits her down very calmly. He gives her a glass of water and they both have a cigarette. And whilst the children are in the bathroom screaming, he basically almost comforts her, calms her right down, and then he strangles her. And whilst the kids are in the bathroom screaming, their mother is being strangled and he kills her. And he uses a cord. Now, the cord becomes very, very important in his crimes because it's a special cord that is used on Venetian blinds. It's extremely strong. There's no way you could possibly break it. And he also, after he kills her, he then leaves semen on her panties. And those panties were left next to the body. Now, the whole thing about not actually raping the women... it's this bizarre sort of gratification that does not involve intercourse. I don't know why. I don't know whether that's ever been explored. But whilst he was still with the victim, the phone rings. And he jumps up and... he leaves. He had to get out of there really quickly. The terrible, insidious thing.
I read something different, Dad. I read, and I don't know how verifiable this is, but I read the child that was stopped at the store. So his name was Steve Relford,
right.
The 5-year-old. I read that Steve was watching the act going, was watching the act through a crack in the door. Right. And then one of the other children, his brother, I think, broke the bathroom window, which scared BTK off. And then Steve apparently ran in and tried to untie the mum, but couldn't do it because, you know, it's a
terrible
5-year-old.
But whatever, so whatever.
Phone call, broken window, something scared him.
But the terrible thing, Paul, about this particular thing is that he would have gone into the bathroom and killed the children. Without a doubt, definitely, because they interviewed him later, many, many, many years later during a confession, and he said that he left abruptly because he said the phone rang, but he said he had to leave early.
Right.
Now, that can it tells me that he had unfinished business, and he had killed two children before. This was his second foray into, you know, why would you leave? Anyone? No, that's one of the terrible things about this particular person was his ability to kill anyone, be it male, female, child. And the terrible, one of the terrible things about this is that on that day, he would have then gone home and to his kids and to his wife, and he would have sat down that night and probably ate with them, and he may have even prayed because he was tied up in their church as some sort of, you know. Yeah, it's the ability to compartmentalize. If I see a cockroach on our kitchen floor, even though it's a cockroach, I have to wrap it up in paper, and then I know that if I just put it in the bin, it'll crawl, make its way out. So I have to kind of kill the cockroach, but I do it in such a way that I still find upsetting.
Right.
I can't see a cockroach on the floor and just go and squash it, like in Men in Black. And people, listeners out there, will be going, John, what are you talking about? That's ridiculous. But I still find it problematic to kill anything living. We had a big spider come down in the middle of our kitchen, a really big daddy long legs, and it came down on a single thread. So I, about 2 feet above the spider, I wrapped my hand around the thread. Christine opened the door and I took it out and put it in the bushes. You know, but then to think about killing a human being, shooting it, strangling it, then the body's lying there, and then you jack off and fucking do whatever and take photographs, which we haven't really touched on. Maybe next episode we'll start to get a real sense of how this guy operates, because we're only scratching the surface, Paul.
Yeah.
We haven't got into any of his really messed up shit. This is all pretty tame.
Well, it's a timeline, and you know, as established, there was a big gap last time, Dad. Mm-hmm. Now we're in March the 17th, 77, with the murder of this woman, but the next murder happens December the 8th.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we're back into that period where he's, you know, he's back on the prowl. So next week we're going to look at the next murder, which is the murder of a woman called Nancy Fox. This one's a bad one. They're all bad ones, folks, obviously. Yep. But we just want to thank you for hanging out with us today and listening to our episode about the BTK killer. Obviously, this is part two of a multi-part episode arc. Don't worry, Loose Ends is going to, as usual, keep kind of taking the sting out of things at the tail end of each week. But thank you so much for listening to yet another episode of Loose Units, The Shadow Files. Take it easy, and we will see you very, very soon for more Loose Units. But Dad, that fucking hammering, I swear to God.
Sorry. Fucking hammering.
Hang on. If they listen to this, they're going to feel terrible.
Yeah, well, fuck. No, it's all good.
Doing their jobs. It's okay.
They're doing their job.
Yeah.
All right, mate. Talk soon.
Talk soon. Bye.
Bye, mate.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.